preparing your principal of church in Fullerton and our religious education committee that's hosting this event. We are fortunate to have Michael Dowd here tonight. He has connections with the United Nations Nobel laureates, as well as many science and religious leaders. Humanity is experiencing an unprecedented global integrity crisis, highlighted by collapsed economies. Michael Dowd will provide a colorful PowerPoint presentation that shows how this was predictable, possibly avoidable, and he will provide an inspiring path forward by discussing human nature, values, and social systems. Please join me in welcoming Michael Dowd to speak on the global integrity crisis and how it relates to Thank God for Evolution.
Hi. I'm so grateful for air conditioning. Yeah. I'm curious, how many of you were not here on Sunday? Okay, wow. Okay, great. Well, in that case, those of you that were here on Sunday, please forgive me. There will be a few things that I'll share that I also shared on Sunday morning. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. My name is Michael Dowd. My wife is Connie Barlow, and we permanently travel North America preaching. We've been living on the road for 7 years now, and that's all we do. We permanently travel North America, sharing with religious and non-religious and sometimes even anti-religious audiences how a mainstream understanding of science can inspire us to live lives of greater love, compassion, generosity, care, consideration, and that sort of thing. And what I've been focusing on lately, the program that I'll be delivering tonight, the first time I delivered this program was at the United Nations for the Values Caucus there about almost 3 months ago now. And it was so well received that it's now become my standard evening program. The other program that I sometimes deliver that I'll have components in tonight is called The Gospel According to Science, Evolutionary Good News. And what I'm meaning there is, what's the good news? What's inspiring? In other words, are there things from a mainstream scientific understanding, what 97 or 98% of the scientists of the world agree with? Nothing woo-woo. But is there something, are there things that we can know about the nature of reality that can give us a deeply inspiring way of thinking about our own lives and our species and moving forward in some kind of a sustainable way? And both of these are based on things that I talk about in my book, Thank God for Evolution, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. Now, y'all probably saw the side of my van when we came in. We got the Jesus and Darwin fish kissing with hearts between them. We get some interest. We spent a month in Texas not long ago. Got some interesting looks down in Texas. Had a couple of interesting gestures flashed our way. We pulled into Lawrence, Kansas, and this biology professor looked at the side of the van and he goes, "Oh, great, you just piss everybody off." Sometimes seems that way. Here we are at the Creation Museum, you know, the museum just south of Cincinnati, where they believe that the juvenile dinosaurs were with Noah on Noah's Ark. They had a security guard watch us for 2 hours. You don't know about these radical evolutionaries. My wife Connie's a noted science writer. She's written 4 science books, from Gaia to Selfish Genes and Evolution Extended are both MIT Press books. The Ghost of Evolution was Amazon.com's top recommended science book for 3 months when it came out in 2001. Green Space, Green Time, The Way of Science was actually featured on the cover of the UU World. For those of you that aren't Unitarian Universalists, that's the national membership magazine of the Unitarian Universalist Association. I'm actually married to somebody who's been on the cover of the UU World twice. I think that is like totally cool. Now, have any of you seen this image yet? This is one of my favorite images of all time. This is an uncolored, touched-up photo from the Cassini mission. We sent a spaceship on the other side of Saturn. I'm going to be in y'all's line of sight quite a bit. We sent a spaceship on the other side of Saturn looking back towards the Earth and towards the Sun. The Sun is directly behind Saturn. This is a solar eclipse. In fact, you can see a little piece of the Sun right there. And this little dot right here, guess what that is? That's right, that's planet Earth. We're looking through the rings of Saturn and able to see Earth in the distance. Talk about a perspective shift. From crumbling economies to collapsing ecosystems, humanity is experiencing an unprecedented global integrity crisis. The lack of an evolutionary worldview made the current crisis inevitable, and a deep time view of human nature, values, and social systems provides a clear and inspiring way forward. So these are the two rather bold claims that I'm making, and you'll decide by the end of my program whether you think I'm nuts or not. But the lack of an evolutionary worldview made the current crisis inevitable, this is what I'm claiming, and that a sacred understanding of evolution, specifically an understanding of human nature, values, and social systems from an evolutionary perspective, can provide a clear and inspiring way forward. Now, one of the things that I've been criticized for, and I think accurately over the years, has been trying to cram too much stuff into an evening program. So at the end of my program tonight, I'll take about 7 or 8 minutes and I'll describe the DVDs that we sell of the other programs that we've done over the last 7 years. So if you're interested in going more deeply into these ideas, you'll know what we've got. But tonight, all I'm going to do is talk about human nature. What do we mean when we use the word God? Is there a way of using God language that even atheists can celebrate, as well as religious people? And what's that got to do with integrity? And what about the trajectory of evolution? And how can this trajectory of complexity help give us guidance for how to move forward in a healthy way? Now, the first thing I want to talk about in terms of human nature is the nature of our language. Humans have always had a daytime experience and a nighttime experience, and the two are very radically different. I mean, we do things at night that we just can't do during the day. We fly. We turn into other creatures or have conversations with boulders or with animals. We walk through walls. We do all kinds of things at night in our dreams that could we do those same things during the day, we'd all be having supernatural or miraculous experiences every day. But we don't typically call our dreams supernatural, nor do we call them miraculous, although we do sometimes call them bizarre. But your dream is only bizarre if you're judging your nighttime experience by daytime standards. When you're in the midst of a dream, it's not particularly bizarre, it's just your dream. In fact, about a month ago, I think I mentioned this on Sunday, that I jumped 100 yards in a full football field in my dreams, and I thought it was really cool until I woke up and realized it wasn't all that special. And day language reflects our daytime experience. It's what science specializes in. It's just descriptive, factual language. Night language reflects our dreamtime experience. And it's poetic, it's metaphorical, it's imagistic. And it can be much more inspiring. In fact, day language tends to focus on the facts. It's just what science is about. Night language is the interpretation, it's the meaning that we give. And a story, a narrative, is what brings these two together. There can be wide agreement on the facts, some agreement on the story, but there's usually strong disagreement in terms of what does it mean, what's the interpretation. This is objective reality. This is subjective. And of course, a story carries a mix of the two. But here's another way of thinking about it. Day language is what so? It's the facts. It's what's objectively real. It's publicly, measurably true. Night language is what does it mean? What's the interpretation? It's what's subjectively real. It's personally and culturally truthful. And our experience as humans is that both of these are necessary. In the same way that if you keep any mammal from dreaming, it will die. Did you know that? If you keep a human or a horse or a bear or an elephant, any mammal, we have to dream or we'll die. There's something about the dream state and the nature of our brains, we have to dream. And yet, as I said before, we dream in a whole different reality. And all cultures, there's not a single culture anywhere in the world that doesn't have a creation myth or a creation story that explains the big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where's everything going? Why are we special as a people? There's literally hundreds, maybe thousands of creation stories. And they all use a blend of day and night language. And you know that you're in the realm of night language, that is something that's inspiring, but not necessarily literally the case, if what you're reading about or hearing in terms of a creation story is something that could happen to any one of us at night, but isn't likely to happen to us during the day. For example, a talking snake in a garden. That's an experience that any one of us could have at night, right? Snakes talk to us at night. But if you were to leave here and go to your car and a snake met you at the front door of your car and started talking to you, my hunch is the first thought that would cross your mind is, okay, who slipped me the LSD? I mean, we don't tend to have experiences of talking snakes during the daytime. But that doesn't mean that story is not true. It means that story may be speaking cosmological truth. That is, it may be saying something true about the nature of reality and our relationship to it, yet it's using the metaphor of a talking snake to make its point. We did a program a couple of years ago, and there was a woman, a biologist actually, who came up to me afterwards, and she said she was trying to read to her 5-year-old daughter a few nights earlier, and she said, I decided I was going to read some nonfiction. And she said about 30 seconds into it, she said, my daughter stopped me and said, no, Mommy, that's a daytime book. She said, read me a nighttime book, Mommy. Out of the mouths of babes. I love this quote from St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the Christian Church's greatest theologians. He says, a mistake about creation will necessarily result in a mistake about God. Now, if that's true, what it means, among other things, is the more we learn about the nature of the universe, right, the nature of creation, if we're not updating what we mean by this word, we may have definitions and understandings of God that are way outdated. In the same way that it would be absurd for somebody to walk up to you and say, excuse me, ma'am, do you believe in reality? How about you? Do you believe in water? It's like, it doesn't matter whether we believe in water or not. We're 60 to 70% water. We wouldn't exist without water. You know, do you believe in life? What's that mean? I mean, it doesn't matter whether we believe in life or an expression of life. Now, what someone says about life, that's believable or not. Somebody can say, life is so kind and wonderful. And somebody else can say, life sucks, it's terrible. That's believable or not, depending upon your experience. But the fact of life just is. It's just a reality. And reality, we don't believe in reality, or let's say this, it doesn't matter whether you believe in reality or not. Reality is something that every plant, every animal, and every human being can't not deal with. In fact, I love this quote from Philip K. Dick. He says, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. And that is what I'm pointing to. What evolution theology points to, when we use the word God, we're not pointing to some being up there out there that can be believed in or not. We're talking about reality. A personification of reality. A sacred name for reality. I mean, if you lived in the Pacific Northwest, which is where this picture was taken, several hundred years ago, before we understood glaciers, okay, this is a boulder that has been left by a glacier. See, we now know that there's no geologist in the world that I know of that would disagree with, is that somewhere between 17 and 20 times in the last 2 million years, the ice sheets have come south and the ice sheets have gone back. And every time the glaciers have come south, they've carried boulders with them, and then when they receded or melted, the boulders were left. But before we understood glaciers, how would your tribe or your culture or your people describe, what story would you tell about how that boulder got there? You would have had to have some story. There's no way anything this interesting or this weird couldn't have not had a story. So all cultures would have had some story that explained it. And my hunch is, God did it would have been the way most cultures would have talked about how that boulder got there. Now, one culture might imagine God as an eagle that dropped it from the sky, or another culture tells a story of a turtle that brought it up from the ocean, or a loving king or a father that brought it in on a chariot. Now, those different cultures use different night language stories to explain ultimate creativity, how that came to be, how everything came to be. But God did it would have been the way most cultures would have talked about how that boulder got there several hundred years ago. Well, then, along come geologists and start explaining this in a natural way through glaciers. And then many geologists would say, oh, God didn't do it. It happened through natural causes. And what we're now finally able to appreciate is that these are different ways, day and night language ways of pointing to the same thing. The words God and evolution are pointing to the same divine creative process. Both answer the question, how did we get here? How did everything get here? One uses the night language of religion, and the other the day language of science. And of course, one's a whole lot more specific. How it happened measurably. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, all the pictures that you'll be seeing, other than the galaxy shots, which of course we got from NASA, But all the other pictures Connie has taken as we've been traveling North America these last 7 years. Arguing whether it was God or evolution that created everything is like debating whether it was me or my vocal cords that produced this sentence. Or like quarreling over whether it was Gaia or plate tectonics that created the oceans and the mountains. Such silly and largely unnecessary confusion will remain the norm until we distinguish and value both day and night language. Humans have always been confronted by an undeniable reality, birth, death, the forces of nature, the laws of the universe, and so forth, that we could neither predict nor control. And each culture naturally and inevitably relationalized, that is, personified reality in different ways. Whenever any story, any culture, or any scriptural passage claims God said this or God did that, what follows is necessarily an interpretation of what some person or group of people thought or felt or wished or sensed that reality was saying or doing, and always as justification after the fact or to make a theological point. Such subjectively meaningful claims are never objective meaningful reality, measurable reality. In other words, had CNN or ABC News been there to record the moment of divine revelation, there would have been nothing out of the ordinary, nothing miraculous to show on the evening news other than what was coming out of someone's mouth or pen or whatever folks wrote with back then. If we fail to understand this, we belittle God and will surely miss what reality is revealing today. And we mock the very notion of a divine communicator if we argue that God spoke more clearly to humanity via the dreams and intuitions of goat herders and fishermen in the distant past than through cumulative evidence discerned by the global community of scientists alive today. In other words, to use religious language, to use night language first, and then I'll say it in day language, God didn't stop revealing truth vital to human well-being back when people believed the world was flat and religious insights were recorded on animal skins. God is still faithfully communicating today, publicly, through the worldwide self-correcting scientific enterprise. Facts are God's native tongue. Now, that's night language. How would I say the same thing during day language? I'd say it this way. Reality didn't stop revealing itself to us way back when. Reality is still revealing itself today, faithfully, through evidence. In fact, reality or facts are the primary way reality shows up. Facts are the way we understand the nature of reality. Now, what this has got to do with integrity... Oh, by the way, can anybody... Do you know what this picture is? Voyager 1, as it was going past Mars, turned around and took a picture. This is Earth and this is the Moon. As Carl Sagan called it, a pale blue dot. Oh, by the way, could somebody please check the air conditioning and make sure it's not too low? It shouldn't be lower than about 72, otherwise we're going to freeze in here. It's perfect now, yes. But what I'm afraid of is it's going to get colder. What I mean by integrity isn't just being honest. What I'm meaning by integrity is being aligned with reality as reality really is. In other words, it's being to use religious language, it's being right with God. It's being aligned with reality as reality really is, not as we wish it was. Getting right with God would be a night language way of talking about it. Being in right relationship with reality is a day language way of talking about it. We'll come back to this notion of integrity. So what I want to now shift to is talking about the human brain and why an evolutionary understanding of our brain can give us really good news, good guidance for how to live lives of integrity, to live lives of that thrive, no matter what the chaos happens to occur in our lives. Because as we all know, compost happens. Evolution provides a much more realistic understanding of our instincts, human nature, the human condition, than was ever possible before. And this comes not out of what was revealed in ancient religious texts in the distant past. This comes out of what reality is revealing today through evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science. Probably the two leading evolutionary theorists alive today are David Sloan Wilson at Binghamton and Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson at Harvard. Now, they're not actually related, but they do sometimes write together. And David's got this great quote. He says, our unique attributes evolved over a period of roughly 6 million years. They represent modifications of great ape attributes that are roughly 10 million years old, and mammalian attributes that are roughly 245 million years old. We also harbor vertebrate attributes that are roughly 600 million years old, and attributes of nucleated cells that are perhaps 1,500 or 1.5 billion years old. If you think it's unnecessary to go that far back in the tree of life to understand our own attributes, consider the humbling fact that we share with nematode worms the same gene that controls appetite. At most, our unique attributes are like an addition to a vast multi-room mansion. It is sheer hubris to think that we can ignore all but the newest rooms. We now have technology that allows us to see the human brain at work while it's working. While somebody's thinking about their best friend or their worst enemy or somebody they're fantasizing about or something that they had for lunch today or whatever, we can map out where the blood flows are, where the neurons are firing. And one of the things that we've been able to discern is that our brain does not show evidence that it was designed by an all-knowing, supreme intelligent designer outside the universe that knew exactly how to design the perfect brain for humans to thrive in the world that we today have to live in. What our brain shows tremendous evidence of is that it evolved or was created over millions of years in an additive sort of way. There's the most ancient part of our brain, more recent still, and then the most recent part. The reptilian brain is the brain stem in the cerebellum. This is the part of the brain that's concerned with the basics of survival. And then after puberty, also reproduction. In fact, you could say that the reptilian brain really only cares about the three S's: safety, sustenance, and sex. Or you could say what this part of the brain is really good at are the five F's: fight, flight, freeze, food, and copulate. Come on, I'm in a religious setting. What do you expect? The old mammalian brain, right? This is the hippocampus, the amygdala, the hypothalamus. This is the limbic system. This is the part of the brain that's concerned with feelings, emotions, bonding, kinship. Status is very important to mammals. Also play. You don't find reptiles playing in the way that you find all mammals playing. And also, I mentioned reciprocity. See, if I'm nasty to you, you're pretty much instinctually going to want to be nasty back. But if I'm kind and generous to you, you're pretty much naturally going to want to be nice back. It's hardwired. It's one of the reasons why it's so important to have laws in place that we can't give politicians significant gifts. Because even if this part of the brain thinks they won't feel indebted, this part of the brain can't not feel indebted. The neocortex, only two new drives come into being with the neocortex: the drive to comprehend and the drive to predict. Now think about it. Comprehend and predict. For what? Like, why would evolution produce an organ that was really good at comprehending and predicting? So these parts of the brain can get what they want more effectively. It's why we are masters of self-deception. We are absolutely brilliant at rationalizing. See, I can deceive you so much more effectively if I've already deceived myself. And then the most recent part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobes, this is the part of the brain that's concerned, it's sometimes called the executive center of the brain. It's all about good judgment or poor judgment. It's the last to develop in young people. See, parents know this. Car insurance companies know this. See, it's concerned not only with good and bad judgment, but it's concerned with more than just one's own self. It's concerned with the larger social whole that it's a part of. It's also our sense of the divine or our sense of ultimate wholeness or ultimate reality are all part of this part of the brain. All of our vows, our commitments, our promises, our declarations also are rooted in this part of the brain. In fact, if you ask somebody who's hooked up to a functional MRI machine to think about their marriage vows or anything they're most committed to, this is the part of the brain that's stimulated. And it only develops between the age of 23 to 25. And so young men who have a lot of testosterone, which means they're taking greater risks, because the higher the testosterone, the more risk-taking typically occurs. Without good judgment, it's not a surprise that men under the age of 25 are so much more expensive to insure. Now, I'm pretty much using standard day language. Okay, this is pretty much the way that almost any scientist would talk about this stuff. But Connie and I discovered years ago, about 4.5 years ago, that if you want young people, high school students, college students, and especially grade school kids, to think this stuff is cool and to talk to their peers about it, day language ain't going to cut it. You need some night language help. So we've got some night language animals to help us out here. Those of you who are here on Sunday know I pulled out a few of these. So we've got our lizard legacy, our fur little mammal, our monkey mind, and our higher porpoise. So again, the lizard legacy is safety, sustenance, survival, and then also sexuality after puberty. The fur little mammal is feelings, emotions, bonding, kinship, status, and play. Also, notice there's a demarcation here. What I'm trying to get at is it's not all warm fuzzies. There's something very dangerous that happens in that part of the brain. It's called in-group, out-group mentality. See, we love and care and cooperate with our kind of people, but we can demonize and oppress them. And of course, we got stories that typically tell us to do the same thing. Virtually every culture has this, and that's going on in this part of the brain. The monkey mind is a term that comes out of Buddhism. The monkey jumps from branch to branch, eats a little fruit, eats a little fruit. It's like a rational, verbal part of the brain. We're rarely in the present moment. Did you ever notice? We're thinking about the past. We're worried about the future, right? It's one of the reasons why our meditation and mindfulness practices, our contemplative practices, are designed to still that ongoing, verbal, rational monkey mind and help it stay in the present moment a little bit more often. Be here now, as the saying goes. And then our higher porpoise is obviously our sense of higher purpose. It's our sense of God's will or our higher power or, again, our commitments and vows and this sort of thing. When Connie, you all saw, that those of you here on Sunday know the puppets that we use. Connie did a program with kids. Now, obviously, when we talk to first and second graders, young kids, about our lizard legacy, we don't talk about sexuality. We just talk about safety and sustenance. Well, and you know, when you feel stressed out, and you just find yourself walking over to the refrigerator, you open up the freezer, you take out the ice cream, and you think to yourself, no bowl needed. Because when we're stressed out, for millions of years, if you were an animal and you got stressed out, you might need a lot of energy, right? You didn't know when you were going to eat again. So eating made a lot of sense when you were stressed out. And of course, our monkey mind is always trying to figure things out. Right? It gets worried and stuff. Well, Connie did a program with kids with puppets. And she about a month later, like 3 or 4 weeks later, this first grade boy came home and told his mother, said, Mommy, we had a fire drill at school today. Now, this is the kid's first fire drill ever. Try to remember your first fire drill, right? This is a big deal. And the mother said, well, tell me, what was it like? He said the sirens were all going and we all had to go out to the street. He said, and I told myself, monkey mind, calm down. Lizard legacy, you're not hungry. Like, is that incredible? Monkey mind, calm down. Lizard legacy, you're not hungry. This is a first grader. And who's doing the witnessing? See, even though this part of the brain doesn't fully develop until the age of 23 to 25, it was enough developed in this first grader because this is the part of the brain that does this witness capacity. Understanding our instincts can help us understand some of the things that we find problematic about ourselves and others. It can give a window into that. And the saving good news, or the gospel used to use traditional Christian language, the saving good news, in part, is that we can move beyond denial, judgment, or even wrestling with to appreciate the fact that we all have an unchosen nature. We all have inherited proclivities. We have aspects of ourselves that we didn't choose. We just find ourselves this way because it makes really great evolutionary sense that we have these instincts. We wouldn't be alive today if we didn't have them. For example, who of us in this room chooses to be attracted to foods that have sugar, salts, and fats? You may think you choose it. You actually don't even have to choose it. It's too important to our survival. Anything that important to our survival is never left up to conscious choice. It's hardwired. Because for 99% of human history, it wasn't easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. So having a craving for them allowed our ancestors to survive long enough to reproduce. Yet today, it's very easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. Yet we still have these cravings. Now, there's a mismatch. In fact, I can say, by the way, I'm like totally impressed with the turnout. I thought we'd have a third of the number of people here tonight. But I can say something with confidence, mathematical certainty, that there's none of us in this room that would be alive today. There's not a single one of us that would be alive if some of our ancestors weren't really, really good at putting on weight and holding on to that weight through the harsh winters, through the droughts, through the lean times. In fact, those humans that couldn't do that got lost to the gene pool. And guess what? Our ancestors were so generous they passed those genes on to us. It's our unchosen nature. Did you know that there is a scientifically shown correlation between the amount of testosterone in a human being, men and women both, and how much that human being tends to think about sex and how much they tend to take risks? There's a woman, a friend of mine up in the San Francisco Bay Area. She had to wear testosterone patches. She was on hormonal therapy. And she told me, she said, after 2 days, she said, I couldn't stop thinking about sex. She said, is this what guys have to deal with? Well, the answer is yes, it is, actually. I mean, did you know that men have 20 to 50 times the testosterone that women do? Now, this is not true of all men and women. Some women have a lot of testosterone. In fact, my daughter is life's ever-present reminder to me that there's a wisdom larger than my ego at work. I was a peace activist for most of my adult life. Take a guess at what my daughter does in the world. She's a staff sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. Not only that, but my daughter is the second woman in U.S. history to be on the All-Marine wrestling team. That's right, my baby girl wrestles for the Marine Corps and kicks butt. And her pacifist daddy is so damn proud of her. But here's the interesting thing. Men and women both have a certain base level of testosterone. We all have a base level of testosterone. But then, when there's a rise in status, there's a corresponding rise in testosterone. And this is true for all men, and it's true for about half women. Okay, it's not true for all women, but it's true for all men, gay and straight. And remember before when I talked about that we can't not interpret our experience? Well, we will always make meaning of our experience. Right? Even if you say something's meaningless, you're making it mean nothing. Right? We are meaning-making animals. And so let's say you've got a great relationship to your spouse, your partner, right? There's no temptation. It's easy for you to be in integrity. And all of a sudden, you get elected into public office. Right? And it doesn't even have to be governor of South Carolina or governor of New York, right? It could be your school board. Or let's say you become ordained. Or you become the manager of your store or whatever. Whenever there's a rise in status where people are looking up to you and admiring you when they weren't looking up to you before, for all men and about half women, testosterone levels go through the roof. And you're going to interpret it somehow. So let's say you've got a great relationship with your spouse and all of a sudden you get elected into public office and you got sex on the brain. Right? Now, what if you interpret that maybe something's wrong with your relationship with your spouse? After all, why would you all of a sudden be dreaming or fantasizing about this other person? Or maybe you're filled with guilt and shame. And you interpret that the reason you're having these immoral thoughts is because your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother ate an apple. Because she was tempted by a snake in a garden. Or maybe you're a real spiritual person and you pray and meditate a lot and you interpret that it's God's will that you hook up with Sarah Jane over here. In other words, how you interpret your experience is going to make an enormous difference, not just in the quality of your life, but in terms of how you impact others and whether you're in integrity or not. When I wrote my book 2 years ago, this guy was in the news. Now, Ted Haggard, the president of the National Evangelical Association, a megachurch pastor preaching boldly against gays and lesbians while seeing a gay massage therapist, and it turns out another guy on the side. And then, of course, our nation was obsessed for a year with President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And, oh, by the way, a few years ago, I read a book review of a book, I forget the title of the book, that talked about the sex lives of American presidents. Trust me, folks, you don't want to know this stuff. When I wrote my book 2 years ago, I said this. I said, so long as religious and political leaders continue to ignore our evolutionary heritage and thus do not put into place structures of support that can withstand the high doses of testosterone that high status and power necessarily confer, then there will be no hope for a less calamitous future. Wasn't it Henry Kissinger who said the greatest aphrodisiac of all is
power?
This is what he was getting at. Now, I wrote this 2 years ago. What have we seen in the last 2 years? Well, we've got our governors of New York, our foot-tapping senator, the mayor of Detroit, presidential candidate, and a couple real new ones here. And see, here's the thing. Most of these guys are Christians. Most of them believe in original sin. They believe in the fall of Adam and Eve. But believing in a mythic night language concept, no matter how accurate, and understanding that night language in a factual, natural day language way are two very different things. One can give a whole lot more freedom than the other. See, we can expect to encounter difficulty with self and others, in part because we have deeper competing drives that have their own agendas. Now, I need to make sure I'm not misunderstood here, okay? I am not saying that the conservatives and the evangelicals get to say, the devil made me do it. And the liberals now get to say, well, Lizard Legacy made me do it. No, I'm not saying that at all. Because it may not be your fault, but it is absolutely your responsibility. It is each of our responsibility. Nobody gets off the hook. This doesn't make it easier to be out of integrity. In fact, in my experience, it makes it infinitely easier to be in integrity. In fact, let me tell you a true story. When the New York Times Magazine, about a year ago, did a feature article on my book, they interviewed this 81-year-old guy that came to my program in northern Florida. Now, again, he's 81 years old. I think he was 80 at the time. He comes up to me at the end of my sermon, which is where I talked about the brain science during the sermon, that sermon. He comes up to me, and he's practically vibrating. He's so excited. He says, Michael, he said, I've got to tell you something I've never told anybody. Now, I don't know about you, but when somebody who's 80 years old is going to tell me something they've never told anybody, I'm all ears. I was like, please tell me. He said, in 1973, he said, I became the vice president of my corporation. Now, it turns out this was a huge corporation. This was a major rise in status. Okay? He said, I had no idea until your sermon why my life began unraveling almost immediately. He said, I had been married for 13 years. I had never betrayed my wife. In fact, I had never been seriously tempted. He said, within 6 months of my promotion, he said, I had five affairs. None of them knew about each other. My wife didn't know about any of them. He said, it ultimately cost me my marriage. It cost me my job. And he said, I've been living with the guilt and the shame of this for 35 years. He said, I haven't told anybody until I'm telling you right now. I got goosebumps. I tell this story. I've told it 100 times. I still get goosebumps. Can you imagine how free this guy felt? And the amazing thing is, he was telling me loud enough that about a half a dozen of his personal friends could hear him. And I was, the shame was gone. In fact, he told me, he said, it feels like I can let go of the boatloads of self-judgment and guilt and start cleaning up the messes in my life. And he did. To his credit, between Sunday morning, which is when I did the sermon, and Tuesday night, which is when I did the evening program like I'm doing now, he called his ex-wife. He told me, he said, I was in tears. He said, I apologize for being such a deceptive, lying sack. Came back into integrity. To use Christian night language, he came back to Christ. He came back to integrity. And I found out 2 months later from his roommate that his depression of the last 14 years had lifted. Now, he wasn't a Christian. He was a humanist. He was an atheist. But he told me, he said, it feels like a born-again experience. He says, it feels like I've got a new lease on life and I'm 80 years old. A couple of years ago, somebody sent us this email, a woman. She said, I could never understand my crazy, destructive drives, why I ate so much when I was full, and why I fell in love with the wrong men. With an understanding of evolution, it now all makes sense. In fact, let me say something about why sometimes women fall in love with the wrong men. This is true for about 85% of women, okay? Not all women, but the vast majority. When women who are in childbearing years, okay, after puberty and before menopause, when women who are in childbearing years, when they are in the presence of a very high status male, their testosterone levels go sky high. So they're taking greater risks, they're thinking more about sex. And they're usually not conscious of it. So they're going to be more flirtatious without even realizing that they are. Okay? There was a woman we stayed with, who's like 70 years old, and down in New Orleans, and she told me, she said she was on testosterone patches, or I forget what form of testosterone, when she was a teenager. Her doctor put her on testosterone, and she said all of a sudden all the boys started looking really good. We also did I did a program at a very large, prestigious Presbyterian church just outside of Philadelphia, just maybe 2 months ago, and there was a woman who came up to me, and she said, Michael, she said, thank you so much for mentioning why women, you know, sometimes, you know, their testosterone levels. She said, I had the most bizarre thing happen to me about 15 years ago, and you just made sense of it. She said, at the time, I had two young kids, and she said, Bill Clinton's motorcade went past my house, and she said, I could actually see him. And she said, this wave washed over me. And I realized that had he stopped, I would have had to give myself to him. And she said, and I was a happily married woman. There's a whole lot more that I could say about why, about some of the similarities and differences among men and women based on our evolutionary heritage that make a lot of sense. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details of that tonight, but I will say this. This book, You Still Don't Understand, Typical Differences Between Men and Women and How to Resolve Them, is the best self-help book for couples on because it's the only one that's deeply grounded in our best evolutionary understanding of our natures. I mean, think about it. What was there to be addicted to 10,000 years ago? What, were you going to run into some fermented berries? Right? And yet today, there's all these activities, these substances, drugs, alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, video games, shopping, and a whole bunch more that's so easy to be addicted to. I mean, 10,000 years ago, if you were a healthy heterosexual man and some woman looked at you lustfully, you were probably supposed to act on it. Yet today, in the privacy of our own homes and our bedrooms and our offices and our laptop computers, we can be exposed to images that our brain didn't evolve to deal with in any healthy capacity. It's not a surprise that we see internet pornography as such an issue. Now, mind you, these are rock formations. And Connie took the pictures. Evolutionary psychology encourages compassion and cooperation because it explores what we all have in common, human universals. In fact, there was a woman, not the same woman, but a different woman in New Orleans, who mentioned that she was a neurobiologist, or she was just getting her doctorate in neurobiology, and she said, the more I learn about how the brain works, she said, the more compassion that I have for myself and others. She said, isn't it amazing and somewhat ironic that science is giving us access to this traditional spiritual virtue? I mentioned before that in evolutionary psychology, our instincts aren't matched for the world that we today have to live in, right? There's a mismatch. Oh, by the way, Connie did not take this picture. In other words, you would not expect a wolf or a bear or an elephant to go counter to their instincts very easily. I mean, would you? It'd be pretty tough for a wild animal to go counter to their instincts. They could probably do it on occasion, but it wouldn't happen easily or often. Yet we humans are expected to go counter to our instincts almost every day, or sometimes many times in a day. Okay, I'm going to say something that's just a little bit crass, so please forgive me ahead of time. Those of us that have been blessed or cursed with a particularly large amount of testosterone, our instincts are to mate it if it moves. Yet if I act on my instincts, I destroy my marriage. My ministry goes down the tubes. I cause tremendous suffering to myself and to Connie, especially to Connie and to others, if I just act instinctually. So the question becomes, how can our instinctual drives, our instinctual energies, serve our marriages and our mission and our life and, you know, what we're most committed to? And that's where this evolutionary perspective offers more realistic hope and possibility than anything I've ever experienced before. I love this one. The universe becomes self-conscious. Eat, survive, reproduce. Eat, survive, reproduce. Eat, survive, reproduce. Eat, survive, reproduce. What's it all about? And we wonder why we occasionally struggle with issues related to food safety and sex. Duh. I mean, in this culture, it takes a lot of courage to walk into a group of strangers and say, hi, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Or, hi, my name is Michael. I'm a sex addict. Or, I'm an overeater. What's true is that, hi, my name is Michael, and I'm a human being with mismatched instincts. See, it's true for everybody. This removes the stigma. It is true for everybody. You interpreting the insights of evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science religiously. We vitalize, we realize, that is, we make real a mythic concept that was true in a night language way, but now we can understand it in a day language way. For example, now we can understand in a realistic day language way why it is that we and our loved ones sometimes struggle with unwanted habits and why our most important relationships can occasionally be really challenging. This is the realizing of original sin, the realizing of the fall of Adam and Eve. It's taking those night language and showing how they point to something that's real. I mean, if you lived 500 years ago before we had microscopes to see bacteria, that was before we could even see bacteria, and you knew somebody that had an infection, it wasn't difficult to understand infection before we had microscopes. It was impossible to have a day language, factual, natural understanding of infection. In the same way, it wasn't difficult to understand the large-scale structure of the universe before we had telescopes to even see other galaxies. It was impossible. Well, in the same way, 2,000 years ago, or 3,000 years ago, it wasn't difficult to understand our evolved brain. It was utterly impossible. But what we would have understood, had we been paying close attention, is what we all know through our experience, which is we all say, I'll do that, but we don't. We say, I'll never do that, but we do. We say, you can count on me for that, but they couldn't. What's that about? Well, the fall of Adam and Eve, original sin, are awfully accurate night language intuitions about what we can now speak about in a natural, factual, day language way. And given the nature of our brains, there is one and only one sure path to joy, freedom, and wholeness. And it's the path of integrity. It's the path of being right with reality. And every religious tradition, this concept is at the heart of every religious tradition. I would challenge you to find any tradition in the world that doesn't have this at its heart. Now, different traditions use different night language ways of talking about this. In fact, you know, can anybody think about a Christian night language way to say this? There's one path to salvation, Christ. That would be a Christian night language way of pointing to this exact same thing. And other traditions have other ways of talking about it. Connie and I have two websites. TheGreatStory.org generates about 250,000 hits a month. It's just an educational tool. And then this one here, ThankGodForEvolution.com. I'm going to circulate a couple of clipboards because about once every month to 2 months, occasionally it's even 3 months, we send out an email newsletter that lists all the new stuff we've added to the website, things that are happening in this evolutionary spirituality movement or religious naturalism movement. If you put your name and email address down, I promise you two things. One is you're not going to get more than one email a month, and you can easily get off the list anytime you want, and we don't give your email address out to anybody. Okay, so the last component that I want to talk about before we open it up for questions and response is the trajectory of evolution. Evolution's arrow, or evolution's major breakthroughs in complexity. In other words, I sometimes call it the nested emergent nature of creativity. Or when I speak in more conservative religious settings, I'll talk about the nested emergent nature of divine creativity. And what I mean by that, and I shared a little bit of this on Sunday, but I'll go ahead and repeat myself, is that this nested nature, this nested emergent nature of creativity is something that there's just no debate about. Whether I speak to atheists or evangelicals or, you know, Hindus or Buddhists or Christians, or it doesn't matter. No matter where I speak, nobody debates the nested emergent nature of creativity. Because we know this evidentially. We know this empirically. Subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within organisms, within planets, within galaxies. That all nested levels, every level can create. Every level can bring something new into existence that didn't exist before. Stars are creative. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from Carl Sagan, in fact, when I use this quote on Sunday morning, sometimes I'll say, this morning's scripture reading is from cosmologist Carl Sagan. And it's the way he ends his Cosmos series. He says, we are the local embodiment of a cosmos grown to self-awareness. We've begun to contemplate our origins, star stuff pondering the stars. See, the atoms of our bodies, other than hydrogen, which was created right after the great radiance or the Big Bang, right? All the other atoms were created inside stars. And we don't believe this. We know this. We can measure this. We can see which kinds of stars, red giants and supernovas, that are creating these atoms. Now, of course, remember before I said you can't not interpret? See, to say that we are stardust is a positive interpretation. One could also say that we're actually just the nuclear waste of dead stars. That's also an interpretation. I prefer the first one. And when I talk about the nested emergent nature, what I mean is we see greater complexity emerging over time out of lesser complexity, not without setbacks. There are setbacks. But life just keeps dusting itself off and creating this greater complexity. In fact, you could say that the universe as a whole, okay, I'm not talking about every species, but the universe as a whole has gone from simple atoms to more complex atoms, to molecules, to more complex molecules, to creatures, to more complex creatures, to societies and more complex societies. And it's one unfolding, emergent process that we grow out of. Human beings are literally, and I shared this on Sunday, but I'm going to repeat myself, humans are literally the universe, after some 14 billion years of unbroken evolution, now becoming conscious of itself. We're nature uncovering its own nature. We're the earth becoming aware of itself. In fact, since so many of you weren't here on Sunday, I'm going to repeat two quotes, my favorite quotes from Brian Swim, who's a professor of cosmology. He says, this just helps people sort of get this stuff. He says, 4 billion years ago, the earth was molten rock, and now it sings opera. Right? Earth was once molten rock, now it sings opera. And nobody put anything here. When the Bible, like Genesis 2:7, speaks of God forming us from the dust of the ground and breathing into us the breath of life, that's a true story. It's a traditionally sacred way, a mythic or a night language way of talking about the fact that we grow out of the dynamics of the planet itself, and it's a divine creative reality of the whole or ultimate reality that makes that possible. Here's the other quote from Brian Swim that I also mentioned on Sunday, where he tries to compress the whole history of the universe, 14 billion years, into two sentences. A little audacious, but I think you'll like it. He says, you take a great cloud of hydrogen gas and you just leave it alone, and it becomes rose bushes, giraffes, and human beings. Here's a visual image of this greater complexity, greater interdependence, and greater cooperation at larger and at wider scale, both in the pre-human world and in the human world. And this is not debated. This is not considered controversial. But this also is not teleology. See, there are many ways of talking about evolutionary directionality and complexity. They're not accurate scientifically. Okay, I'm being very specific about how I talk about this. In fact, I better be, because one of the world's top experts in complexity is sitting here. So I better have my stuff right. What this means is that we see complexity emerging out of lesser complexity in a nested sort of way. In other words, this is not saying that there's any intelligence outside the system. We don't have evidence of an all-knowing intelligent designer that somehow knew exactly how to either pre-program it or manipulate it or make it go in a particular way. That's not what the evidence suggests. What the evidence suggests is that from the perspective of now looking back, we in fact see this greater complexity, interdependence, and cooperation at larger and wider scale. And we are part of that process. We're nature uncovering its own nature. As I shared on Sunday, we didn't come into the world, we grew out of it. In the same way that apples grow out of an apple tree. See, the old debate, is it all just determined by an all-knowing God, or is it all just random chance? It's a false dichotomy. The universe is creative. And creativity has elements that had to be and elements that are purely free. Human cooperation once existed only within small family groups. Cooperative organizations expanded to produce multi-family bands, then tribes, then agricultural villages, cities, and empires, then nation states. Now some forms of economic and social cooperation span the globe. When we understand how this has occurred, and this is obviously a simplification, but I think this is important to realize, this can give us guidance in terms of moving forward. Formerly independent, or in some cases competitive entities, face some crisis, some challenge, some chaos, some difficulty. And when they figure out or stumble into the awareness that they can survive together better than they can independently, and especially when they align self-interest and the well-being of the whole, a new level of complexity emerges. So now let's call these tribes, before we had families and clans. Now we've got a bunch of tribes interacting. They face some crisis, some challenge, some chaos, some difficulty. They figure out how to align the self-interest of each tribe with a new order of complexity, and a chiefdom or a kingdom emerges. And then you got a bunch of chieftains and kingdoms and so on. This is essentially, again, it's a simplification, but this is essentially how prokaryotic bacteria created the eukaryotic cell, how eukaryotic cells created multicellularity. And this is how we've gone from cooperating among families and clans to where we're now cooperating at the scale of a planet. In fact, I remember hearing a few years ago a guy with a radio voice, a real deep radio voice, he was talking about the fact that we now cooperate with people our grandparents hated or feared. And he said, from our good friends who brought you Pearl Harbor, Mitsubishi Motors! And see, understanding this gives us some guidance for how to move forward in a healthy way. Until we see the entire history of the universe as scripture, and all I mean by scripture is dependable guidance, and create laws and incentives that align the self-interest of people and organizations with the well-being of the body of life as a whole, that is our planet's self-interest, we will continue to toxify the air, water, and soil, drive other species to extinction, and be hounded by religious, political, social, and economic crises. In my opinion, nothing is more important for moving forward in a healthy way than for individuals, corporations, and nation states to align this natural self-interest. See, all entities are self-interested. In fact, Richard Dawkins, best-selling, amazing book, I'm not talking about the God delusion, I'm talking about the selfish gene, okay, talks about that genes are self-interested. All entities at all levels are self-interested. So how to align that natural self-interest with the well-being of the whole, that's the key. And the key that will be moving... The key to humans moving forward in a healthy way is to align the self-interest of individuals, corporations, and nation states with the well-being of the planet. So the individuals, corporations, and nations that do well to the larger common good benefit, and the more good they do, the more they benefit, so they're incentivized to do as much good as possible, and individuals, corporations, and nation states that disregard or harm the common good are taxed or penalized or there's moral strictures, so that it's in their self-interest to do the right, just, ecological thing, and it's also in their self-interest to not do the unjust, unecological thing. This is the key thing. That if we do this one well, almost everything else will follow naturally. If we fail to do this, most of the other good that we do will not be enough. And again, where we get this understanding isn't from ancient religious texts, as inspiring as many of us find those. Where we get this is from the entire history of the universe interpreted in a meaningful way. Until we come to see through sacred, deep time eyes, atheists and fundamentalists will continue to blame each other for the world's ills. Liberals and conservatives will keep trashing one another. And collectively, we'll fail to see that enormous global challenges are actually divine evolutionary drivers guiding us to greatness. And again, what I mean by divine is it forces creativity. Whatever cultures have meant when they use God or goddess language, at the very least, what they're pointing to is the creator. That which creates, that which brings new things into existence. So let me conclude on this note, and then we'll open it up for questions. I grew up Roman Catholic. You can't get the Catholic out of me. This is my cosmic rosary. I've got 269 of the major transformational moments in the history of the universe represented in beads. Each bead signifies some significant event in the universe story. Don't worry, I'm not going to do it, but I can tell the entire universe story bead by bead. And one of the things that I have represented are the major catastrophes, the major violent, chaotic, destructive episodes in Earth's history. See, one of the things that we know, and again, I say know rather than believe, is that the universe is not just a friendly, happy, put on a smile, isn't a nice day, it's all wonderful kind of place. There's chaos and destruction and breakdown and violence and extinctions. In fact, you can't even have a universe without this destructive, chaotic side. And yet, one of the things we recognize when we've got the whole thing represented visually like this is that on the other side of all the major catastrophes, and I have all the major extinctions represented in Earth's history, on the other side of every one of them, is this unleashing of huge creativity, new possibilities, new opportunities, and in many cases couldn't have even been there without it. In other words, let me say it as strongly as I possibly can. the primary driver for billions of years of creativity, like the number one thing that has catalyzed and furthered creativity for billions of years, is chaos, breakdowns, and bad news. Now, I don't know about you, but in the current economic situation, it gives me a little bit of hope. I mean, think about your own personal life. I can't speak for you, but I can definitely speak for myself. The most difficult, painful, challenging times in my life, the kind of times I would not want to have to relive, have also unquestionably been the most important growing times. And the only people I know that that's not true for are people that are still holding on to their resentment. But if we can let go of the resentment, we find that's where we grow most powerfully. And I can say this. No matter how long or short this recession is, or even if it becomes a decade and a half long depression, right? On the other side of it, I can say confidently that humans will be cooperating more intensively than we even are now. No matter what our attempts to inform, it is our ability to inspire that will turn the tides. Tell me a creation story more wondrous than that of a living cell forged from the residue of an exploded star. Tell me a story of transformation more magical than that of a fish hauling out onto land and becoming amphibian, or that of a reptile taking to the air and becoming bird, or that of a mammal slipping back into the sea and becoming whale. Surely, this science-based culture of all cultures can find meaning and cause for celebration in its very own cosmic creation story. Do you know where I found this quote? 10 years ago, it was on the cover of the UU World. And I was so blown out of the water, I was so impressed with this quote, I decided I'd track down and marry the author. And folks, that's a true story. This is the book of Connie's that we have with us tonight, Green Space, Green Time. You could say the spirituality of science, the way of science. It's how the evolutionary sciences and the ecological sciences can enrich your communion with the whole of reality. It's a natural theology or natural spirituality. In fact, this is one of the leading books in what's called religious naturalism. Now, I'm almost 6 foot one. Okay, I'm a 6 foot and about a half inch. These guys are tall. The guy on the left is John Mather. He's NASA's senior astrophysicist. He's the 2006 Nobel Prize winner in physics. The guy on the right is Craig Mello. He's the 2006 Nobel Prize winner in medicine and physiology. The reason that they invited me to the Library of Congress, which is where this picture was taken, was that they were doing a program together there called The Origins and Evolution of Life in the Universe. And Craig sent me an email about a month ahead, because they both had read my book. And Craig sent me an email and said, Michael, come to the Library of Congress and get your picture taken with us. It'll be great for your book. I thought it was a grand idea. I flew from Phoenix. Here's what they said about my book. John Mather said, the universe took 13.7 billion years to produce this amazing book. I heartily recommend it. Folks, as an author, it just doesn't get any better than that. Craig Mello said, the science versus religion debate is over. A must read for all, including scientists. Now, I don't know if this is going to get me on Oprah or not, right? But I figure it can't hurt. And you know when you go to a movie and before the feature film, they have movie trailers, movie clips of movies that are to come? We created an 80-second book trailer for my book, and I wanted to share it with you. Connie's created 4 study guides for groups that want to use it as a book study, groups that want to take their time, those that want to go through it fast. All these are downloadable for free from our website. This is the it's slightly abridged audio version of the book. I recorded it. 2.5 chapters aren't there, but most of it is. And this is a companion DVD that's often used with study groups. This is 4 hours, and the first 2 hours of this program, I delivered a program 3 years ago in Colorado Springs, Colorado, to a group of Christians on Tuesday night, to a group of atheists, agnostics, and free thinkers on Wednesday night. And both groups loved the program. And I find that hugely encouraging. Because if we can't find ways of cooperating across ethnic and religious differences in the next 50 years or so, we're in serious trouble as a species. Questions, response, feedback. Yeah, let me talk about that, because actually I've delivered quite a few times to progressive evangelical groups. Now, obviously, any minister that believes that evolution is of the devil and all the evils of the world could be attributed to Darwin doesn't invite me into the church in the first place. So I don't get invited into the most antagonistic settings. But I get invited a lot into Christian settings, Catholic and Protestant alike. And let me talk about this personal God. Because if we are going to have a meaningful relationship with reality, the whole of reality, the largest nesting doll, right? we have to use metaphors and analogies that are meaningful. And all of think about every meaningful relationship that you have in your life, no matter who or what it's with. Right? Chances are all the meaningful relationships in your life are with he's, she's, and living it's. We don't tend to have meaningful relationships with non-living it's. I mean, I really like my stool, but I don't have a meaningful relationship with it. And so it's not a surprise that we see personal metaphors used all over the world for relating to reality. And so in that sense, I have a deeply... Okay, last week, I started to share this on Sunday, I had a profound experience of the divine when I was in the Grand Canyon for a week just last week. I spent 8 days rafting through the Grand Canyon. I relate to reality in a profoundly intimate, personal way. Now, do I believe that there's a conscious being up there, out there somewhere? No, I don't. But do I have a deeply meaningful relationship because I talk about it in night language in terms of my personal relationship to God? You bet. In fact, Connie and I have personified North America. We say we're falling ever more in love with Nora. We've given a proper name to this continent. North America, we call her Nora. And I'm telling you, it's true. We have a more intimate relationship with this continent as a result of simply giving it a proper name, not relating it to... It's kind of like the difference between Earth, proper name, and the Earth, little e. And so I had a reporter in Dallas, Texas, ask me, he said, do you believe in a personal God? And I turned it on him. I said, do you believe in a personal continent? He was like, what? He said, no, I don't just believe in a personal continent. I relate to this continent personally. And that's the same way I have a relationship with God. So that works for some evangelicals and it doesn't work for others. But what I'm trying to do is reach those who are open to thinking about revelation, not just in ancient books, but revelation through science, through evidence. And I found that a lot of moderate, certainly the liberals, but the moderates and some of the more progressive evangelicals and progressive conservative Catholics will actually have loved this. In fact, my first book, Earth Spirit, sold only about 10,000 copies over a period of about a decade. More than half of them were nuns. Catholic nuns. We get invited to Catholic monasteries and convents all the time. So, yes, it doesn't work for all. In fact, I did a program just maybe a month ago in a evangelical church, a progressive evangelical church. And the vast majority, this exact same program, and most of them loved the book. Now, I did have two people walk out. Well, actually, entropy and chaos drive complexity. You've got two corresponding dynamics. I mean, it's talked about in different ways. Ilya Prigogine, in 1979, won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for exactly this, that there's entropy, which is the universe is winding down or that energy dissipates, okay? But this is driving, this is catalyzing creativity at larger and wider scale. In other words, entropy feeds a negentropic process. And if you play both of these out to their... See, the term and the concept of entropy emerged when we had a mechanistic understanding of the universe. We had no understanding of emerging complexity over time when the concept of entropy was first introduced. It was based on our understanding of machines and our understanding that the universe is like a complex clock. So now, it's been the last 40 years or so, we've begun to, and probably longer than that, we've begun to also see there's this negentropic process. And if you play both of these out to their logical conclusion, just as the universe is achieving heat death, it's also organized itself at the scale of the universe, and the whole universe knows that it's one with the whole, and then the game's over, and maybe it births a new universe or something. I don't know. So it's a really interesting... you could say it's a paradox, but it's... Both are considered factual. Both are considered the way reality really works. First of all, reality, different cultures have used different unpersonal metaphors to talk about reality. Many cultures have talked about the goddess. And what they focused on is the nurturing or abundant or creative aspects of reality. See, reality is mother-like. Reality is father-like. Reality is like all kinds of different metaphors. And so, no, I was not meaning to imply that God is a man or masculine or that reality is necessarily masculine. Reality has all those components. But I would say that that testosterone does drive the many men unconsciously in ways that they're pretty clueless about. And, as I said before, when women are around high-status men, and sometimes even around high status women, their own testosterone levels rise. It's really fascinating. But I didn't mean to overemphasize testosterone. That was just one aspect. Connie and I do a 2-hour program where testosterone is only one small component of what we're talking about. Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating question when we start looking. And see, most of the research that's been done on this actually hasn't been done with humans. It's been done with primates. Primatology gives us a lot of evidence in terms of how, like, for example, when an alpha male becomes an alpha male, their testosterone levels will often triple or quadruple. But then if they lose status, if another one becomes, their testosterone levels plummet. And again, it's not just testosterone. It's dopamine. It's other brain hormones and chemicals as well that give us a feeling of elation, of power. In fact, did any of you see the movie, what was it, Spider-Man 3 or something like that? That movie was all about testosterone. It was all about testosterone. And the negative impact that can have on a psyche when it's kind of dosed with testosterone. So in terms of gay relationships, it's interesting. How do men relate to other men in testosterone? It's a more complex question than I really have time to get into here now, but it's a fascinating one. And also when you start looking at gay relationships, from an evolutionary perspective, gay and bisexual behavior makes sense. There's over 500 different species that have gay and bisexual behavior. And when you start looking at the fact that sexuality is at least as much about bonding, when you've raised erotic energy with somebody, there's a bond that there wasn't there before. And so we see this again among both men and women, and it makes sense evolutionarily. Yeah, let me touch on that, because that's really important, and it's important for a lot of people. The word meaning, something is meaningful if it fits in a coherent way with a larger perspective, a larger story, a larger sacred narrative, or some larger context. And that happens at all levels. We could talk about this. For most of us, what gives our lives meaning is having some sense that we are participating in or a part of or an expression of a larger meaningful process. And for example, let me talk about this notion of life after death or whatever, because again, day and night language are vital. The first time that I ever was asked about day language and night language, actually what happened was it came to me literally as a night language insight. I was in my ordination process and I took the United Church of Christ statement of faith. You know, we believe in God, body, body, body. And I took it and I chunked it out one sentence at a time and I interpreted it from the sacred evolutionary perspective. And there was a gentleman who stood up at the end of my program. I had, those of you that are athletes or artists, you know when you're like just in the flow? It was one of those nights. I was just on. Everything went right. And then about 5-10 minutes before the end of the evening, this guy stood up and he said, Michael, he said, I've been coming to these ordination hearings for, I think he said, 38 years. He said, I can't tell you when I've come to one that I was more like, whoa. However, he said. And there was a way he said, however, that I knew I was in trouble. He said, there's a little boy in me, and my little boy that's inside of me wants to know the kind of questions that little boys want to know. He says, like, you know, life after death, consciousness, souls, that kind of stuff. He says, in fact, what my little boy wants to ask you is, where is your mentor, Emery Wallace, now that he's died? See, I have been guided for 2.5 years through the ordination process by an 84-year-old retired minister. Actually, he was 82 when I met him, but he died when he was 84. And I fell in love with this man. And everybody in this room knew and loved Emery Wallace. And he died 3 weeks before my ordination hearing. And he was my mentor. And we're all grieving his death. And this guy stands up and says, the little boy in me wants to know, where is he now? What's your evolutionary theology say about that? I had two thoughts immediately race through my mind. One of them was, damn, this evening had gone so well. The other one was, boy, this is your ordination hearing. You better speak. And I didn't know what I was going to say. Call it faith, call it trust, call it whatever. I just stood there and I breathed. I didn't try to figure out what I was going to say. I just breathed. And then I opened my mouth and this is what came out. And I don't ever remember thinking about day and night language before. And I don't ever remember reading about it anywhere. But this is what came out. I said, the only way to answer the question, where is Emery now that he's died, is to use day language and night language. Day language being everyday discourse, what we normally talk to each other about during the daytime. Night language being the language of our dreams, of poetry, of myth, of symbol. And I said, as I said before, we do things in our dreams that we can't do during the day. So let me answer the question, where is Emery now that he's died? But let me use first day language and then night language. First, the day language side. I said, Emery is being decomposed by bacteria. Ultimately, all that will be left is his teeth and his bones. His genes continue to live on, his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, and so forth. His impact, his influence, lives on in those he's touched and influenced, those they've touched and influenced, those they've touched and influenced, and so on. But if I stop there, I haven't told you the truth. I've told you half the truth. And I want to address this whole inner, non-measurable aspect of human experience, of human existence. I've got to use some kind of night language. Now, there's not one night language way of doing it, but I said, here, let me try. I said, Emery is at the right hand of God the Father, worshiping and giving glory with all the saints. Or I could say, Emery is being held and nurtured by God the Mother. Or to use a Tibetan symbol system, I could say, Emery has entered the Bardo realm. In other words, there's no one right symbol system. There's no one right mythic or poetic or metaphorical way of speaking about the inner non-measurable aspects of reality. But unless I use some kind of language there, I'm not going to address what most people need to find meaning. Because think about it. Facts just sit there. Facts don't inspire. They have to be interpreted to be inspiring. And yet there's never only one right way to interpret any set of facts. And the way that I've now come to think about it is that true faith, and again, this is just how I think about it, but for me, faith, any faith that doesn't include trusting that whatever happens on the other side of death is just fine, is no faith at all. Fear of a hellish, terrifying after-death scenario or hope of a blissful, heavenly after-death scenario are just that, fear or hope, not faith, not trust. So I don't know what comes after death. I don't know if anything comes after death. My hunch is we all come from, or we all go to, the same place that we came from. But what does that mean? I don't know. But I do know that I am a cell in the body of a larger planet that's a part of a larger creative universe, and that I'm doing everything that I can in my lifetime to ensure a just, healthy, beautiful, sustainable life in the future. And I want to say this in conclusion about this, is that I think one of the greatest tragedies is that so many people think that science gives us a meaningless, chance, purposeless universe. And until we understand that our best scientific understanding of evolution can give us a deeply meaningful, inspiring way of thinking about our role in the body, I think we're going to continue to see the kind of thing that we're people. The only place that people are going to get their hope is from taking the otherworldly stories in a literal way. And I'm not saying that that's not true. I'm just saying that there's a difference between day and night language is a way of talking about it. Yeah, I think that we are seeing what you're pointing to. I think is that science and religion are two sides of a single coin. One is the side of what so, the facts. The other is the side of interpretation and meaning. And that we are seeing a dance. Connie and I believe we are both religious naturalists. I don't deny the possibility of what some would call supernatural. But my focus and locus of inspiration is on what's undeniably so about this real universe. And I trust the other stuff. I trust the mystery. And I think that we're seeing science. I believe, now this is a bold claim I'm making, but I believe that science, evolution, will usher religion into its greatness. That a meaningful interpretation of evolution will ultimately usher all the religious traditions into their glory. That no religious tradition could come into its full potential until deep time was understood. For example, I don't think Darwin killed off God. I think Darwin gave us the first glimpse of the real Creator behind and beyond all the mythic portrayals of the divine that we see all over the world. So that's why we believe that evolution will usher religion into its greatness. Yeah, in the far back. Those of you that couldn't hear, she's saying that she had tortoises for many years, and that, you know, they would always get confused when a male tortoise, if a female was there, and the food, they just didn't quite know which direction to go. You know, I just want to honor that. I'll stick around, you know, all night long and answer questions and response and stuff like that. But I just want to honor the time, so I want to take just a few minutes and just describe some of the resources that we have. This is Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3 of The Universe Telling Its Own Story. These are our best-selling kids' books. And we know of a woman that read these to her 4-year-old. Now, this is The Universe Telling Its Own Story, so that's the night language. That's what hooks the kids, right? Now, these are not written for a 4-year-old. They're over the heads of a 4-year-old. But the pictures are so fascinating that the kid stayed with it the whole story and then said to his grandma, "Grandma, is that the way it really happened?" It's like kids are taught fairy tales, but here's science told as fascinating as any fairy tale. We also know of a woman that leads retreats for ministers, and she led a retreat for 65 ministers, and these were her texts. You got to keep it simple for us ministers. If you want to explore this kind of a sacred way of thinking about evolution more deeply, and especially if you want to share this perspective with others very, very inexpensively, what we most recommend are our DVDs. And we say, freely burn as many copies of our DVDs as you want. Each of these is 4 hours of our best programs. We have the covers up on the website. So if you have a color printer, you can print off the covers. And you can go to Office Depot or Staples or Office Max and get blank DVDs and cases very, very inexpensively. It's a great way to share this perspective with your friends, neighbors, and relatives. Oh, by the way, I'm realizing this isn't a really young crowd, so I want to say something, unless it's not obvious. This does not mean put them in a fire. I don't want to take anything for granted here, you know. The main program that I delivered for almost 3 years is on both of these, so there's an overlap. The second 2 hours of this and the first 2 hours of this are the same program delivered to different audiences. And it's the main program I delivered for almost 3 years called Beyond Sustainability, an Inspiring Vision of the Next 250 Years. And the reason that I picked 250 years is because if you compress the 14 billion year history of the universe into 100 years, like if you make 14 billion years equal 100 years, at that time scale, every minute is 250 years. So think about it. If we've got 100 years of trends and patterns and tendencies to study and to learn from, do you think there's a few things that we might be able to say with some degree of certainty about what the next minute might be like? Well, I'd hope. Otherwise, we're in serious trouble and we have not been paying close attention. It's a very hopeful perspective. Again, I talk about what I do and what I don't mean by directionality on this one. Also, those of you that are familiar with Ken Wilber's four-quadrant model or spiral dynamics, I also use those as a way of talking about complexity. Many people told me this is the most hopeful material I've offered in the last 6 or 7 years. I compare how the mechanistic paradigm, that is the idea that nature is a complex clock and God's a clockmaker. Did you realize that we couldn't have that worldview until we had clocks? It emerged in 1543 with Nicholas Copernicus. There was a 150-year period of scientific and philosophical revolution, an early Enlightenment period. This is when hard liquor was invented. Think of the 1960s, 300 years ago. A conservative backlash, a very chaotic, intensive phase, and this 40-year period here, almost everything changed. Major systemic change, both in Europe and here. And this emergent paradigm that I've been talking about tonight is going through an almost identical process. And if this pattern repeats, which right now there seems to be every evidence that it will, in the next 50 years or so, I think we're likely to see the kind of major changes that we saw during this 40-year period. I believe we will see a global democratic revolution, an environmental and biomimicry revolution. What I mean by biomimicry is where we mimic biology rather than mimicking machines in our redesign of law, medicine, politics, economics, education. And I believe we will see a worldwide spiritual revival as we see the naturalizing, the realizing of every religious tradition. And again, all we're talking about is the next minute on the cosmic century timeline. These aren't the challenges that we might have to deal with. We're going to have to deal with these things. And then what are the things that we may or may not have to deal with? But by God, if we have to deal with any of these things, they're going to be huge. This is nuclear, biological, or chemical, or genetic, nanotechnology, or robotic, error or terror. So this is the scary stuff. I don't leave people here, but we take a square look at the bad news because we're not going to have authentic hope if we're in denial. And so we take a look at the bad news, but then I say, okay, what are the long-term and the short-term positive trends that we can bank on? We can trust that these trends will continue. And many of these things have been at work long before humans ever existed. And then finally, what's the likely good news? I'm not talking about crossing our fingers and toes and praying that Jesus, the cosmic janitor, comes and cleans up the mess we've made. I'm saying what's likely in the next 250 years? And this is, again, very hopeful. I spent about 40 minutes on all this good news. And all of that is on both of these DVDs. Now, they also differ. So the other 2 hours of this one is where I spend a half hour on each of these gifts. how this perspective reconciles science and religion, how it transforms our views of chaos and bad news, how it evokes inspiring, empowering visions of the future, and how it broadens our circles of care, compassion, cooperation, and commitment. What's unique to this one is where I spend the other 2 hours going into all the Christian stuff. So if you have any Christians in your life, or if you're a Christian, you might be interested in this. And then finally, you all have gotten a big dose of me, but you didn't get any of Connie. This is 3 hours and 15 minutes of Connie. It's only 45 minutes of me. So it's got two of my most popular sermons that I do in more moderate to liberal settings, and the rest of this, the other 3 hours and 15 minutes of it, is Connie. Connie does a 45-minute program called Coming Home to North America. It's how to become native to this continent. See, being a Native American isn't just having Native American blood, it's a mind and heart set. And when we understand the story of North America that all the different sciences have given us, this gives us a profound insight in terms of how to become native here. This is our most popular program of all, We Are Made of Stardust. And this one here is the one that I believe she'll be remembered for generations from now. Death Through Deep Time Eyes. She takes a look at all the different sciences that have anything to do with death, and shows how death is not only natural and generative, that is, it's creative, but that death is no less sacred than life. If it weren't for the death of stars, there could be no planets, there could be no life. If it weren't for the death of plants and animals, there could be no food. If it weren't for the death of fetal cells in the embryonic stage of development, we'd all be spheres. Once we circumnavigated the globe, that is, once we had empirical proof that the world was finite, not infinite, you combine the understanding of a finite world with an understanding of population, and you realize very quickly, in a finite world, if you want a world of children, you have to have the death of elders. Because think about it. In a finite world, if all you got is birth with no death, very quickly, you're wall-to-wall people, wall-to-wall skunks, wall-to-wall bacteria, 60 feet deep. It doesn't take long. Until we grasp that death plays a vital and necessary role in an evolving cosmos, Christianity will continue to be limited by unnatural, otherworldly notions of the gospel. Medical technologies will continue to prolong physical and emotional suffering and provoke family discord. And the medical industry will continue to underwrite the widening gap between the rich and the poor. Few things are more important than transforming how we view death. And you know, the truth is, you were asking the question, gentlemen, I was asking before about more conservative Christians. I have never met a Christian, no matter how conservative, that really believes, that can look me in the eyes and tell me they really believe that an eternity with no challenges or struggle, yet with conscious awareness of the eternal torment of others, would be heaven. We all know in our guts that would be hell. So clearly, I think it's important to look at the night language and say, what is it? How can that be realized? If you get any one of these, please do make copies. If we get it, you know, and if you get two or more, they're $25 each. So, and you know, if you're flat broke, you just have no money, you just lost your job or whatever, and you really want one of these, and you'll make copies for others, or you'll share your copies with others, just pay whatever you can. We just want to get the word out. If you'd like to help further this movement in some way, obviously a discussion group, post a good review up on Amazon. I've actually had some fundamentalists that have been trying to drive my rating down by posting one-star reviews. So if you like my book, obviously a gift copy. I'm on Facebook and Twitter, so if you do those kinds of things, you know. And one of the things I'm going to close with is a song. But Connie and I, we do all our programs free of charge. And I'm going to pass out some offering envelopes in the back there or outside there. There's a donation. You don't have to donate anything. In fact, feel free not to donate anything. But if you want to help keep us in gas and food money, and especially if you want to help further this movement in some way, because right now we're trying to work. I want to get, for example, the funding to essentially send 1,000 copies of my book to 1,000 of the leading Islamic scholars and imams, and invite the progressive Islamic folks to try to do for the Muslim world what I'm trying to do for Christianity. So, Just take one of those and pass it on, or don't take one. And I'd like to close with a song. This song will put together so much of what I've been trying to do tonight. And as night language does, because this song, is, as all songs are, they're full of night language. That's what touches our hearts. That's what moves us. And this song just puts it together. Just so much of what I've been trying to do, he just puts it together. And those of you that are familiar with Blue Boat Home by Peter Mayer, this is Peter Mayer. And it's my favorite song of his. It's called Everything is Holy Now. And once you get the tune, which you will pretty quickly, please help me sing along.
Attention to the priest, he would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. When I was in Sunday school, we would learn about the time Moses split the sea in two, Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad that miracles don't happen still. Now I can't keep track, 'cause everything's a miracle. Everything, everything, everything's a miracle. Wine, water is not so small, but an even better magic trick is that anything is here at all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but finding where there isn't one.
Please, help me sing along.
When holy water was rare at best, it barely wet my fingertips. But now I have to hold my breath, like I'm swimming in a sea of it. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down, but I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy now. Questioning child's face and say it's not a testament, that'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come and say it's not a sacrament. I tell you that it can't be done. This morning outside I stood and saw a little red-winged bird shine like a burning bush and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down, but I walk it with a reverence there, 'cause everything is holy now. Thank you.
Isn't that great? These are 13 of his songs related to the universe story that we have out there. I'd like to close with a quote. This quote is from one of my, certainly, my main mentor in my life, Thomas Berry. He just died about a month ago at the age of 94. He called himself a geologian. Theologian of the Earth, right? And this quote, it's a poem, a short poem. It's called "It Takes a Universe." The child awakens to the universe. The mind of the child awakens to a world of wonder. Imagination to a world of beauty. Emotions to a world of intimacy. It takes a universe to make a child. Both an outer form and inner spirit. It takes a universe to educate a child. It takes a universe to fulfill a child. And the first obligation of any generation to its children is to bring these two together so that the child is fulfilled in the universe and the universe is fulfilled in the child while the stars ring out in the heavens. Thank you.